They aren't lacking, they're not returning this even.
Good morning, everyone. Let the record show that it's 9:00 on February 3rd, 2015, and this is the time and place scheduled in the Public Service Commission hearing room in the State Capitol Building in Bismarck, North Dakota, for the hearing in the matter of Public Service Commission versus Northern Excavating Company, Inc., cases number PU-13877, PU-13878, PU-13879, PU-13880, PU-13881, PU-13882, PU-13883. My name is Rosellen Sand, and I am a procedural administrative law judge who has been designated to conduct this hearing. I'm going to have the parties state their appearances now, starting with counsel for the commission, Mr. Armstrong.
Mitch Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General, representing advocacy staff of the commission. With me is Victor Shook, as advocacy staff, a public utility analyst.
Okay. And Mr. Lindbergh from Northern Excavating?
Yes, I'm Robert Lindbergh from Northern Excavating Company.
And you have no one with you at the table, so?
No.
Okay. And then also the commission advisory staff, who is?
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, counsel for advisory staff. And with me is Patrick Fahn. He's the director of the Division of Compliance and Competitive Markets.
Thank you. Also present today are the Public Service Commissioners, the Chairman Julie Fedorchek, and Commissioner Brian Kalk, and Commissioner Randy Christman. At this time, do the Commissioners have any opening remarks?
All right, Your Honor, I'll start out as the portfolio holder. I just thank you, Your Honor, for setting it all up, and a good audience out there in attendance just to kind of walk through the process. This is not the first one of these damage prevention hearings the commission has done, but it's one of the earlier things that we're working with. And just the process, for those of you that haven't seen it before, the judge kind of set it up. You've got Mr. Armstrong and advocacy staff that have actually brought these series of cases to the commission. You've got the commission's advisory staff, where Ilana Jeffcoat is our lead attorney, and of course Mr. Lindbergh on behalf of the company. So the case will be made. There'll be back and forth questions. The commissions will ask a lot. We won't make any decisions today, of course. But I'll set this up that over the last 6 years, the commission has really taken a larger stance in damage prevention to make sure we're protecting the infrastructure of the state of North Dakota. We've levied fines all the way from $0 with some things to $12,000. The range of fines is $25,000 as a max for each individual violation, and there's a lot of violations today. So for me personally, I think the big thing we need to go through is go through the process that we'll ask all the questions we'll have today. And there's actually three hearings that are set up today. There's one that starts right now at 9 o'clock for one series of cases. There's one that starts at 1 o'clock, same groups, just a little bit different alleged violations. And one that starts also today at 3 o'clock. So we set them up that way because it really seemed like there was three different sets of issues with cases that dropped into those individual ones. So the way the schedule lays out, we'll go from 9 o'clock until we're done. But if we happen to finish before the next hearing, we still won't start the next hearing until 1 o'clock. So the process, I think, will work itself out, and I look forward to asking a lot of questions today. And just thank everyone for coming out.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Fedorchek.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Commissioner Kalk, for laying all the rules and the protocol and all that. The issues today are just a result of one of our challenges of growth in North Dakota. There's a lot of players doing a lot of work in North Dakota today, and there's a whole bunch of underground infrastructure to protect. So with so many people involved, there's a lot of room for error, a lot of room for miscommunication, but everyone is responsible for doing their part and taking, you know, all the necessary steps to protect this underground infrastructure. In terms of pipelines, third-party strikes are one of the leading causes of pipeline leaks. So there's just a lot of potential damage that can be done and potential public harm. So we need to, you know, work through the issues today and make sure that all that needed to be done is done, and find out who's at fault here and move on. So look forward to the hearing and a fair hearing and a thorough hearing and a good solid decision forthcoming. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Fedorchek. Commissioner Christman.
Thank you, Your Honor, but I think pretty much all the teeing up has already been done. I don't think anything left to be said. I'm ready to get into the into the case.
This hearing is a result of several complaints brought by the Public Service Commissioner against Northern Excavating, alleging that Northern Excavating Company, Inc. violated North Dakota Chapter 4923. And I think we kind of already got that from the commissioner's statements. There are seven cases that have been consolidated for this hearing, and the commissioner is seeking to impose penalties in each case on each complaint, as set out in the notice of hearing. Commissioner Call kind of laid out the proceeding and how we will go today, but I just kind of want to run through a couple of things. I understand that the parties have discussed stipulating to the admission of exhibits. Is that correct, Mr. Armstrong?
That's my understanding.
And Mr. Lindbergh, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I have exhibits 1 through 16 in this case.
Yes, we offer those at this time.
Okay. Mr. Lindbergh, you are okay with the commission considering these documents and making its determination?
Yes.
All right. They will be admitted then. Okay. And then there was also a question earlier raised about whether the rules of evidence were going to apply, and I don't know, Mr. Armstrong, if you addressed that.
I did not address it with Mr. Lindbergh, I guess, Your Honor, before the hearing. My preference would be that we do not, well, I don't know if commission counsel has a preference on whether we waive the rules of evidence or not.
Well, I think that we usually do waive the rules of evidence, so we can in this case.
The rules of evidence will be waived here today, but the standard is still whether the evidence submitted is relevant. So we won't talk about things that don't pertain to these cases, only things that will help the commission make its determination in this matter.
Judge, if I might just interrupt here for a second and make sure all the people talking speak up close to the mic so that the recording picks you up, and if we need to reference that, it's very clear.
Thank you. And also another thing to remember is because this is being recorded today, if you use your hands to talk or nod your head, that will be picked up, obviously, by the internet, but it might not necessarily make it into the recorded record. So please remember to give your answers to questions audibly. Thank you. All right, the procedure again. At this time, we will have first the presentation by the Commission's counsel, Mr. Armstrong, and he will call his witnesses. After he's had an opportunity to question those witnesses, Mr. Lindbergh will have an opportunity to ask questions of the witnesses, and then the advisory council will also have questions of the witnesses. And we may, I believe the commissioners may also have questions. We may go through that process more than once, depending upon how many questions come up that people want to ask. But generally, that will be the process we will follow for Mr. Armstrong's witnesses, as well as the process for Mr. Lindbergh's witnesses. So at this time, I guess I better talk a little bit about the decision. I think the commission alluded to they won't be making a decision today, but they will make a decision at a later date. And if anyone disagrees with that decision, they have the right to appeal that under the Administrative Practices Act, which is North Dakota Century Code, Chapter 2832. If the proceedings have to be transcribed for an appeal, the individual making the appeal or the commission, if it appeals itself, which probably isn't going to happen, would be responsible for transcribing those documents. So some of you have done this before. Mr. Lindbergh, you may not have. Do you have any questions before we proceed?
No, it's all pretty new to me.
Okay.
This procedure.
If something comes up and you don't understand it, let us know.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Mr. Armstrong, do you want to make an opening statement?
Yes, very briefly, just to kind of guide through what we intend to do this morning and maybe a little bit throughout the day, but more for this morning. It's our intent. These cases we're all dealing with this morning deal with Reservation Telephone Cooperative, and we're going to call Shane Hart, who is the Assistant General Manager of the company, and we'll also be calling Cassie Steele as a witness, who is the line locator and somebody who was present shortly after the lines were struck in all of these cases. We'll also call Victor Shook to discuss the recommended penalties we're proposing today. We've got the exhibits admitted, so we'll we'll try to refer to those when we're talking about them, and that's we believe the evidence will show that there were violations of section or chapter 4923 in this case, and we'll ask that a proposed penalty be accepted and assessed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lindbergh, do you want to make an opening statement now or before you begin your case?
I'll make an opening statement just basically that we have, or that Excavating has been in the excavating business of this type for well over 31 years and have never encountered anything like this, and we will show that there was no neglect in any of these locate hits.
All right, thank you. Mr. Armstrong, do you want to call your first witness, please?
Call Shane Hart.
Mr. Hart, in North Dakota, whenever someone testifies at an administrative hearing, one of my responsibilities is to inform them of the penalties for perjury. Those penalties are up to $10,000 and up to 5 years in prison, and it is a Class C felony. Understanding those penalties, do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth here today?
I do.
All right. And you heard me outline what we were, the procedure, so I'm going to turn you over to Mr. Armstrong at this time. Go ahead, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mr. Hart, are you employed?
Yes.
Who are you employed by?
Reservation Telephone Cooperative.
Could you just briefly explain for us Reservation Telephone Cooperative, and if it's okay with you, I'll refer to them as RTC throughout the day. Can you explain what RTC's business is?
RTC provides landline phone, internet, and video service throughout northwest North Dakota, including the city of Ross.
And what is your position?
I'm the assistant general manager.
What do you do as the assistant general manager of RTC?
I assist the general manager and general leadership of the cooperative and staff leadership deal with things that escalate to this nature.
Does RTC have various underground facilities providing services in and around the city of Ross, North Dakota?
Yes.
Could you explain what services it has? Or facilities, excuse me.
We have fiber facilities, various size fiber facilities, and also copper facilities.
And do those facilities provide the landline phone, internet, and video service you described earlier?
There is no video service in Ross, but yes, landline and phone. Landline phone and internet, sorry.
As part of your employment with RTC, do you get involved in cases where its underground facilities are damaged by excavation?
If it's one event, probably not, or two, but multiple events, yes.
And when do you get involved?
Usually after a couple by the same excavator. I do get involved, and honestly, we haven't had that many.
You submitted the third-party complaints on behalf of RTC that kind of started the ball and got us here today. Is that correct?
Yes.
And those of what we have, those complaints are what we have marked as exhibits 1 through 7. Correct.
Yes.
And I understand that when you submitted these, you later determined, found out that the date on these was mistaken. Is that true?
That was my mistake, yes.
Can you just briefly describe what happened?
I actually pulled the wrong dates when I used those, and I should have used the invoice date, and it was my mistake.
So when you say you should have used the invoice dates, we're talking about the invoice dates that are reflected on Exhibit 9?
Yes, correct.
Other than that, is the information in the third-party complaints Exhibit 1 through 7 correct and accurate to the best of your knowledge and information?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
So you were then obviously involved when several of RTC's underground facilities were damaged in the city of Ross in August, September, and October of 2013?
I got involved in probably September-ish.
Could you kind of tell us what your involvement's been in that process?
My involvement has been it came through our on-site cable locator, through our cable coordinator, informing me that we had multiple damages by the same excavator in a very small area, and each one of those was felt to be neglect of taking care careful and prudent excavation near our facilities.
As it was reported to you, was that the neglect on behalf of one company?
Yes.
Who was that company?
Northern Excavating.
Does RTC participate in the North Dakota One Call system?
Yes.
Can you explain the process RTC uses of locating its facilities when it receives a one-call notification?
When a one-call ticket is received by RTC, it is dispatched to the appropriate locator. We have several cable locators that are responsible for certain areas within our service territory. The area of Ross is one particular area. These locates were all dispatched to Cassie Steele, who is responsible for locating all these facilities.
So you got involved sometime in September, and that was kind of in the middle of when these breaks were occurring. Is that correct?
I'd been informed in September, yes. And then there was an additional cut in September and two more October 1st.
And as part of that, do you oversee, the invoicing and repairs made as a result of those cuts?
I usually do oversee that, yes. Again, I'm not always reviewing that invoice in detail when it goes out until it goes unpaid.
And in this case, did RTC invoice Northern Excavating for the damages caused?
Yes, we did.
And is that invoice, one of them anyway, included in Exhibit 9?
Yes.
I would like to go through Exhibit 9 with you if we could. As I understand it, Exhibit 9 does contain the invoices for all of the damages we're dealing with this morning. Is that correct?
Yes.
The first entry on that invoice, I understand, deals with case number 879. Could you tell us what facility was damaged in that incident?
Ex- 879 was a fiber facility. Is that correct? Yes.
If it could, it would help you to look at your third-party complaint for 879. It's Exhibit 3. Second page.
Yeah, my mistake. I'm sorry. 879 was a 25-pair copper cable.
And do you? What does a 25-pair copper cable look like?
This is what a 25-pair copper cable looks like.
And on what date was that copper cable damaged?
That one occurred on August 13th, 2013.
Okay. I see you're looking at the date in the upper left-hand corner. Under the description, it says cable cut August 2nd, 2013.
I'm sorry, yes. I was looking at the invoice again. Sorry, cable cut 8/2/2013.
And what repairs had to be made to that cable as a result of the cut?
That cable needs to be spliced, all 25 pairs.
Okay. And how much do those repairs cost?
We billed for the cost of the repairs only, and that was $1,082.14.
Could you maybe walk us through briefly what those, like the Scotch-Loc Red, 3M Ridge Enclosure Kit, and the labor items are on that?
So the Scotch-Locs is a piece of equipment. I have it. This is what a Scotch-Locs look like. The cable actually goes in there in each side and gets pinched together when they're splicing that to reconnect that cable, the connectivity to it. The enclosure is another piece of equipment, and I apologize, I don't have one of those along that actually covers the splice. And then the rest of that is the labor.
And so the damages incurred or the repairs necessary from case number 879 were how much?
$1,082.14.
And is that basically the bare minimum it costs to repair this?
That is absolutely the bare minimum it costs.
The next entry on the Exhibit 9 is a date of 9-3-2013, cable cut of August 15, 2013, and I understand that is case number ending in 878. Is that correct?
Yes.
Could you tell us what underground facility was damaged as a result of that incident?
Four fiber drop.
Do you have an example of a four fiber drop with you?
This is what a four fiber drop looks like. There's four pieces of glass in here.
And what repairs had to be made as a result of the August 15th, 2013 incident?
Again, that cable had to be spliced.
And what we have listed here, again, is the labor and the materials used to repair that?
That is correct.
And is that, again, the minimum cost of repair for that damage?
It is, yes.
You turn to the second page, please. I understand that first entry deals with a case we'll be hearing this afternoon. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the second entry dated 9-3-2013, cable cut August 7th, 2013. Is that the cut that we're dealing with in case number ending in PU or in 877?
That is correct.
Could you explain what piece of facility was damaged in that case?
24 fiber.
And which one is the 24 fiber? Do you have an example of that?
This is a 24 fiber. There's two 12 strands, ribbon strands together.
And what repairs had to be made as a result of the damage on August 7th, 2013?
Again, that cable had to be spliced.
And again, what's the cost to RTC to make those repairs?
$3,653.73.
And is the information within that entry, the materials and labor, reasonable, and again, the minimum cost to repair that?
Yes.
Moving on to the next one, where it's stated September 3rd, 2013, with the cable cut of August 9th, 2013. Is that the invoice for case number PU13880?
Yes.
What facility was damaged in that incident?
That was one of our larger cables, maybe the largest in Ross, at a 144 fiber.
And what repairs had to be are going to be needed for that facility?
Again, each of those need to be spliced.
And does the entries on the bottom of that page describe the materials and labor necessary to repair those materials?
It is. This one's a little bit unique, and that one is actually sitting in a conduit. And that conduit was, or duct system, I'm sorry, and that duct system was damaged as well. So the costs on here are a little bit different because we have to bore a new duct 500 feet, and that's the cost there of $6,000 for that, plus the cost of the duct. And then, of course, the splicing costs and pulling that fiber 500 feet. Through the duct.
Is the $11,547.68 the reasonable and necessary cost it's going to be to repair the damage caused on August 9th, 2013?
Yes.
Moving on to the last page of Exhibit 9, the top entry dated 9-13-2013 for a cable cut on September 9th, 2013. Is that related to the third-party complaint in case number ending in 881?
Yes.
What facility was damaged in that incident?
That was a 75 pair cable, copper cable.
And do you have an example of that with you today?
This is a 75 pair copper cable.
What was necessary to repair the damage from that incident?
Each of those need to be spliced.
And again, the entry on there, does it describe the reasonable cost to repair made necessary by the damage on September 9th, 2013?
Yes.
Moving on to the next one, October 24th, 2013, related to a cable cut of October 1st, 2013. Is that what we've alleged in case number PU13883?
Yes.
And what facility was damaged in that incident?
75-pair copper cable, this one.
And does the invoice there describe the repairs necessitated by, again, that incident?
Yes.
Moving on to the final one, does that October 24th, 2013, relating to the cable, another cable cut on October 1st, 2013, that's what has been assigned case number 882, is that correct?
Yes.
Could you describe what was damaged and the repairs necessary for that incident?
The very same 75-pair copper cable.
So,
was cut twice on the same day.
And as a result of that incident, the damages were, the necessary repairs made would cost $1,113.39?
Correct.
I'd like to turn your attention to exhibits 14 and 15 for a second. Are you familiar with these exhibits?
Yes.
Could you tell us what exhibit 14 is?
Exhibit 14 is a map of the city of Ross prepared by our assistant operations manager. In that, we have the red the lines in there that denote the locations of each cut. 14 has the fiber facilities in that town.
So what you have here, if I'm reading it correctly, is the case numbers listed of the general location of the cuts for each one?
Yes.
And it's a map of the city of Ross?
Yes.
And could you explain what Exhibit 15 is, please?
Exhibit 15 is another very same map of the city of Ross. This map shows the copper facilities in that town in blue and the locations of the cuts in black.
We were talking about the invoices earlier. What did RTC bill Northern Excavating for the damages caused in these cases?
We billed them for the time to repair those facilities and for any materials needed to repair those facilities.
Was that at cost?
Yes, it's at our cost.
Has that invoice been paid?
No.
All the questions I have.
All right, thank you very much. This time, Mr. Lindbergh, do you have questions?
Yes. When RTC installs their lines for a community or residential, you know, anything in the city of Ross, who installs these lines?
We use a combination of our labor and also contracted labor.
When were these lines put in?
Maybe you want to clarify which lines you're talking about. That might help you answer your question.
The fiber lines, we'll start with. When were the fiber lines installed?
I'm sorry, I don't have a date as to when they were installed.
Were they installed by a private contractor or by RTC forces or labor forces themselves?
I also would have to verify that. I could speculate, but I don't want to speculate.
Same question for the copper. When were these put in?
I don't have a date for that either. I could find out.
And how about who put those in?
I don't know for sure on that either.
Okay. When when these cables are installed, you know, we'll start with the fiber. Who sets the route where these go?
Our engineer does.
And when he sets these routes, are these routes engineered by a professional engineer?
Yes. Yes.
Are there drawings of these, as-builts of these?
Yes, we would have maps as to these, yes.
Are they given to contractors when they're digging?
If requested, I believe, yes.
When these lines were, when work was being constructed, were locates obtained for the construction for putting, I should back up, I guess, but when the water, the new water main was being put in Ross, were there locates requested through the one call system?
By Northern Excavating? Yes, yes there were.
Okay. this really isn't a question, but it's a general rule. When any contractor that's putting in water or sewer work, whether it's municipal or out in the country, the contractor is usually overseen by a resident engineer, whether it's...
Mr. Lindbergh, I think that this is maybe something you want to testify to.
Okay.
Okay. This is, right okay. Now, we're just going to get his testimony through questioning.
Okay.
But make sure that you remember to testify okay. to that. Thank you.
On the routes of the cables, you mentioned the engineer designs the routes where they go.
Yes.
Do they follow a protocol on right-of-way? Does RTC get a certain right-of-way of where these cables go?
Yes, we do.
Was RTC notified by Catermans, Lee, and Jackson that a project of, you know, the whole city being, new water mains being put in?
I don't know specifically on that, but we are usually notified when those things happen.
Were you aware of the plans as prepared by Catermans, Lee, and Jackson of the routes of the water lines for the city of Ross?
I was not, but again, I'd have to check with our other staff.
You mentioned your engineer, when they design the routes, they follow a certain right-of-way?
Yes.
Okay. you mentioned about your costs for, you know, your splicing and everything. Like on your, there was a invoice for boring 500 feet.
Yes.
What was the reason for the bore of that? Why did they have to bore that?
The duct system needs to be replaced, and that's how they put the duct system in. It's rather than tear up the entire street. It goes 500 feet.
Was that from one pedestal to another pedestal, basically, or?
Yes. I'm not an outside plant guy, but I believe so. That's usually the way that goes. It's from one pedestal to the other.
Aren't they usually about 300 feet apart?
Again, I'm not an outside plant engineer, so I don't know that for sure, but this one was 500.
City blocks are usually 300 feet center to center. When are you familiar where the bore had to be done in Ross?
On the maps, yes, I am.
And can you tell me which... where that was done at? What's the streets?
That bore has not been completed yet because we have not done that bore yet. That facility was fixed and put in as is, but that facility, anytime a change is, anytime we need to do anything with that cable that's sitting in that duct system is now unusable for future use to pull any additional cable through. So we're going to have to replace that duct system. So the bore has not been done yet, but we build the cost as to what it would cost to fix that so that it's a usable duct system again.
But the system is operating, right?
The system is operating today.
Do you have where this bore was, what's the address or what street it's on between? Do you know that?
Central Avenue, but I don't know the exact spot to spot.
Was it between 3rd Street and 2nd Street West in that area?
Yes.
Have you been to the site to see that area?
I have.
You have?
I have.
Do you know the soil conditions there?
No, I don't. It's a gravel street.
But at, from basically 0 feet to 9 feet, do you know what the soil conditions are?
I do not.
Do you know, is groundwater prevalent there?
I do not know.
Do you know what's located on each side of that street from on Central Avenue from 3rd Street West to the alleyway just on the east side of Main Street?
According to the map, there's water, but other than what I see on the map, I don't know specific soil conditions.
A lot of water?
Water.
Could that affect trenching conditions?
I'm not an expert on trenching conditions.
You mentioned locates have been called in for the areas that had been asked for digging operations.
That is correct.
How deep do you bury your lines?
36 to 48 inches. Sometimes they can be as shallow as 24, but its standard is 36.
Could there be a possibility the lines could get deeper than that?
Could get. I don't know the answer to that.
Because of an unknown obstacle that had to be bored around, or telephone pole might be in the way and they had to go around it and go deeper to avoid it, or that's just an example, but do you know on Central Avenue how wide this road is from edge of shoulder to the edge of shoulder?
I do not.
Would 18 to 20 feet be approximate?
I do not know.
Your line locator, Casey Steele, is she employed by RTC?
Cassie Steele.
Cassie, I'm sorry.
Yes, she is employed by RTC.
Do you know, is RTC contacted by consulting engineers when they design a project so that RTC can provide a consulting engineer with cables that may affect a project that's being installed?
We are.
Do you provide them with as-builds?
If requested, yes.
Do you know, was this requested on this project?
I do not know.
What's the percentage, you think, when lines are requested or as-builds requested?
I don't know what the percentage is.
You mentioned the dates were wrong on the invoices. Dates are right, but the other dates are wrong on the complaint.
Yes, when I submitted the third-party damage complaints, I used incorrect dates.
Okay. Did you or any RTC employees observe the digging conditions or the digging operations of the Northern Excavating?
I did not, but I do believe our on-site locator, Cassie Steele, did.
So you mentioned you don't know the soil conditions of what was encountered in any spots, any located rocks or anything?
I do not.
Do you know, do you think elevations have they can drastically change in the city of Ross from, high points to low points, and would that affect the digging conditions?
I do not know if the elevations changed in the city of Ross.
Are you aware on 3rd Street West of the permitting? Was there proper permits for utilities installed on that street for RTC?
Yes.
Are you aware of permits from Cadmus Lee and Jackson for installing a water main on that street?
I have not. I'm not aware of a permit, but I would assume one was obtained.
Are you aware of that a permit was not obtained for 3rd Street West and the new water main that was installed was abandoned in place after less than 6 months?
I'm not aware, no.
It was.
Again, Mr. Lindbergh,
yeah.
Some of these things, it's not going to count, shall we say,
right,
unless you're under oath and testifying. So be sure that you, like the last comment that you made, you need to testify to that yourself.
I guess the thing is that RTC does follow right-of-way routes when they install lines.
Yes, we do. If we get a right-of-way permit, or in a given city, we have a certificate of public convenience and necessity.
Does the city, do they have a representative on hand when these lines are put in so that they know these routes are followed by the right-of-way, or who manages the installation of these?
We installed the lines. Whether there was somebody on site in the city of Ross at the time that they were put in, I do not know that.
The city has given as-belts to these routes?
Again, if requested, yes, there.
That's all the questions I have.
All right, thank you very much. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, do you have questions?
We do not, thank you.
All right. Do any of the commissioners have questions, starting with Commissioner Kalk?
You know we're going to, Your Honor, right? Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Shane, for your testimony. Excuse me if I jump around a little bit here. You talked a lot about the companies RTCs need to splice and that you use the minimum cost. When you splice something, is it typically more or less reliable than it was before it was cut?
It would be less reliable. It will work, but it's less reliable because once you splice that cable, it's never as good as it was before the splice.
So do you figure in the shortened lifespan of the cable in your costs?
Those are not figured into the costs billed to Northern Excavating.
Why not? Why wouldn't you figure all costs in?
That is something we are evaluating at RTC right now in determining an amount to determine that's reasonable to bill for basically a degradation of our cable.
The kind of going off on a little tangent here, but whatever the commission decides, if the Northern Excavating is fined, that money comes back to the general fund. If it's not, they're not fined, then that's the end of it. But what do you use to get reimbursed from the company? Because this procedure is whether the Northern Excavating will be fined, not to reimburse you.
Understand. We use these invoices, the cost of repairing the cable. Usually in the past, RTC has only billed the cost of repairing the damaged infrastructure. We have not billed for, again, any kind of, again, degradation of our cable.
What mechanism can you use, though, if you bill them and they don't pay, per se? Then what do you do?
Well, we will need to consider legal action in court.
I just want to make it clear that we're all communicating this, understanding your cost, but our ability to get that money back to you is not part of this jurisdiction.
I completely understand that.
That's something that perhaps down the road that maybe changes in different settings, but I think that's kind of the way it's been for a long time in a lot of different areas. You testified to one of the previous questions so you've confirmed that there was locates done in all these cases today, these seven cases, correct?
Yes.
And I imagine Casey's going to come up and tell us and talk about that. But how many – back up here. Is RTC is Northern Excavating the only company that you deal with in people that may have damaged your facilities?
No.
In dealings with other companies, what kind of protocol do you usually follow with them if they cut your facilities?
The same as we have done with Northern Excavating.
What would be different, if anything, about your discussion with Northern Excavating and other companies that you work with?
There is really no difference at this point with how we've dealt with Northern Excavating. Again, the only difference maybe would be we have held off on any type of legal action to collect on the invoices that are due, waiting to get through this process first.
So you would view Northern Excavating's communication with you as no different than any other companies?
Well, Northern Excavating hasn't communicated with us at all. They have never contacted RTC in any way that I'm aware of.
That's what I was trying to get to. So is that normal behavior for companies that you operate with?
Usually a company that does damage our facilities, in most cases, admits if they don't, we have a discussion as to where they think they're right, we think we're right, we come to some common ground. There's a negotiation that happens and we move on, I guess, from that point.
Okay. A lot of questions a minute ago about different things from soil types and all that. Walk me through what your role is when you get a locate request.
When we get a locate request, it comes in. We receive in excess of 150 locates every day for our service territory. We get these requests. They come into our locate coordinator, dispatches those to the various locators that we have that are responsible for certain areas of our service territory. Once that locator receives the locates in their area, their responsibility then is to go out, mark that facility, and if there is a contractor there, they often leave their contact information with that excavator. Ask them to stay in touch with them if they have any questions about the markings that they did, about where any facilities might be when they're digging. They ask them, they usually give them a business card, their cell phone number, and forge a relationship there with the excavator.
Probably have more. I should save some of those questions for the locator probably. Have you had any other companies put in question whether your locators are doing proper locates?
Never.
So you feel as if your locators are properly trained?
Yes,
your job?
We do.
Can you give me the total of the cost of your facilities? I know you kind of walked through them, but do you have a total of damages of the cost of your facilities in these seven cases?
It's about $24,595.72.
I think that's all the questions that I had for you. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you very much, Chairman Fedorchak.
Shane, thank you for your testimony so far. Following up on some of the questions Mr. Lundberg asked you, when you use subcontractors, how do you supervise their work?
If we use a contractor to do a job, it's usually engineered. with an engineering firm, a professional engineering firm, and that professional engineering firm oversees the contractor.
Okay. Have you had any difficulties with your contractors or reason to believe their work has been inadequate?
We have not.
Do you have a relationship with one that you use frequently? Or do you bid them all out?
We usually bid them out. We use several contractors, but we have never had an issue with any of them on the work that they've done for us.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a difference in the work done by contractors versus your own folks?
Our own folks do maybe even a little better work the way that RTC wants it done. As it's just like anything, when you hire it done, it's not as good as when you do it yourself. Maybe we're very close to, but that's why we hire an engineering firm, is to oversee that and provide us to make sure that that contractor is doing exactly what we want done. And to my knowledge, we have done that in every case.
Do you receive a final report from the engineer that kind of summarizes what's been done and assures you the quality of the work?
As far as a report, I don't know. They do sign off that it was built to the standards set forth on the contract that they were
hired for,
yes.
Have you had others complaining about challenges in digging without breaking the lines in the wet conditions?
In our service area in general?
Sure.
A few years ago we did in Wantford City. There was some poor soil conditions over there. And there was a contractor there that had a fair amount of trouble. And we did have a few cuts, but in their case, they were very upfront with us that, some of it was their fault, and they did feel that soil conditions was part of it, but they communicated that to us. We actually worked out every situation that there was there.
You worked it out so that?
They paid something on every single one of them.
But maybe not the full cost, is that what you're
possibly saying? Yeah, not the full cost, and some of them the full cost.
Mm-hmm. So with this type of material, What's your understanding of how much more difficult it is to work with it in kind of the wet conditions, and is it a lot easier to have happen what Mr. Lundberg is suggesting has happened?
The material, to my knowledge, and again, I'm not the outside plant guy here, apologize for that, but the when a trench caves in or collapses, the cable can break. And if you have a large amount of a mass of dirt or rock or whatever, it can, break the cable. That would be the only difference that I would see in poor soil conditions.
And what's your understanding of who's responsible for taking measures to assure that that doesn't happen?
The excavator is responsible for that.
In your experience, what's the fix for that?
Well, the excavator needs to take precautions to safeguard a trench that they open up to ensure that the facility is not damaged.
Okay. I didn't calculate the number of hours that your staff worked on these repairs, but I'm curious, what does that I'm assuming you don't have staff just here to make repairs in emergencies, or do you? How does it affect your overall operations when you have these kind of third-party strikes that damage your infrastructure?
It's an extreme hardship on our organization just from the standpoint of we don't have enough labor in the first place. As you're well aware, labor is hard to find in Western North Dakota. We have that labor set out to do different things throughout the day, and we have to pull certain people off other jobs to go and fix something when a cut like this happens, because this is an emergency, this is an outage, and we need to get it up and running right away or as soon as possible.
So what are the kinds of things that don't happen when you have to deal with the emergencies?
Well, you may not get services installed to another customer, whether we are plowing a new line into somebody's house, road move type stuff. There's a lot of road work going on right now. We're trying to stay in front of all that. And when a cut happens in another area, unfortunately, we need to pull those people off as well temporarily to go get these repairs made.
Okay. Have you ever quantified, let me restate this. Has this type of damage and these additional costs from your company resulted in increased costs to your customers, or who's helping to pay for these types of things?
We haven't passed on these costs to customers through any rate increases, but yes, it is causing a hardship on the cooperative because it negatively affects our bottom line. We are spending more time fixing situations like this. When we bill for them and they do get paid, obviously we're billing only for the cost of repair. We're not even billing for the amount of time that those employees are not doing the other things throughout the day that they were supposed to be doing. So we are losing productivity out of the day. We are not billing for that at this point. So when these invoices get sent out and paid, it is just paying purely the repair cost. And again, I as a company, we're evaluating that process.
Have you ever estimated your loss of productivity?
We are, evaluating that right now. We have not.
And you said it affects your bottom line, but it hasn't resulted in increased costs to customers. So where is it coming out? I mean, how are you paying for it?
We're paying for it out of our general operations. It affects the budget. It affects it takes longer to get services installed or to get other repairs made that need to get made because we're out fixing a cable cut like this.
So you're not investing more in your system?
We are not. As quickly as we need to or we should.
Is there anything as a co-op member that those folks are losing credits or anything of that nature that's being reduced or not?
Well, they're losing the ability to get their service in a timely manner, and in some regard, yes, they are losing out on the ability as a cooperative to have capital credits because as our costs to our bottom line go up, those net margins are reallocated to the members. So if there's more costs involved in doing stuff like that, that's less capital credits, net income that's sent back to the members.
Okay. I think those are all my questions for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Christman, you have questions.
Yes, Your Honor. On Exhibit 9?
Yes.
The first and last ones, I neglected to write down which case numbers they applied to. So can you tell me on the first page of Exhibit 9, the very first case, which case number that is?
PU 13879.
So then the very last one must be number 882.
That is correct.
Okay. I have trouble following the labor on people and vehicles per hour and making a match from one case to the other. Is the quantity, is that the number of hours for whatever techs and vehicles are listed in the previous column?
It's the total man hours, correct. The quantity is. So labor is billed at $120 a man hour, and a vehicle is $10 more additional.
I had it here, and now I think it's the bottom one on the second page with the with the 500-foot boring. So is the cost of boring pretty much determined by the length of it, or is a big part of that $6,000 cost just setting it up?
In my understanding, it's cost of boring, and it's so much per foot.
So if it were 300 feet, it would be about 60% of this amount?
If that is correct, yes.
And can you, on one of these maps, 14, 15, or 16, explain to me where this bore would start and end?
If you look at map 14, or I'm sorry, exhibit 14, the best of my knowledge is that bore would go from on Central Avenue, 2nd Street West to 3rd Street West. And I'm not exactly sure of the endpoints there, but it is 500 feet in that general area there.
You're thinking it doesn't go beyond 2nd or 3rd Streets? It's between those two? It sounded like ultimately we're going to have a bit of a dispute here over the distance, so I'm trying to make sure I get on record what your certainty as to the distance.
I know it's Central. I don't know how far into 3rd or if there's any sort of bend in that to go up 3rd. Some information on that.
And okay, and I don't know if this next question is better for her or you, but what, refresh me on or explain more, why does that need to be bored as opposed to dug in that one area?
I there was a conduit system in there. Why that conduit system was in there, I'm not exactly sure, but there was a conduit or duct system in there. And that was what was damaged, and apparently that's what we need to be able to pull fiber back through there. I guess we want repaired what we had there already. Why it was there initially, I would have to ask one of our field people.
Okay, and then I think this is my last line of questions, but the initial confusion on the dates, were you using the dates from some other cases what do those dates correspond to that were incorrect?
I honestly can't believe that those dates were as wrong as they were. I don't know if I, when I was keying, I have no explanation. I am sorry. I don't.
No other questions, Your Honor.
Right. Commissioner Koch, did you have another question?
Yes, ma'am. I just had one follow-up. The a lot of discussion back and forth, a lot of questions about all kinds of issues. But in my mind, this case comes down to the question that did Northern violate North Dakota Century Code by failing to conduct the excavations in a careful and prudent manner? Do you think Northern Excavating did the work in a careful and prudent manner?
I do not.
Thank you, Shane.
I have one more question, too.
Yes.
Sure. I'm wondering if, Shane, you could just go through those exhibits and correct the dates, because I'm not sure what the correct dates are. There's several dates on the sheet, and I'm not sure which ones are wrong and which ones are right.
You can go second, correct that, and redirect.
That would be perfect. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions from the commission members? Thank you. Mr. Armstrong, do you have questions, further questions?
Mr. Hart, I'd first like to talk to you about the dates.
When there is a cut on or damage to one of RTC's facilities, does the company generate what's called a cable cut report?
We do.
And that notes the actual date that the cut occurred?
It is generally does, as long as the techs write the date on the
and
report.
Is that the date that is used to generate the invoice we have in Exhibit 9?
Yes.
So if we look at Exhibit 9, just for example, the first entry For case number 879, it says cable cut 8-2-13. That's the actual date that the cable was cut for that case. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, yes, it is.
And that's verified based on the cable cut reports?
That is correct.
And that would be the same throughout all of those exhibits and cases?
It is. That is correct.
So the dates of actual the cuts that we are dealing with for each case, as we listed and discussed in your previous testimony, is the date, the cable cut date, that it states on Exhibit 9.
Yes.
And not the dates on the third-party complaints.
Correct.
The only other question I have for you, Mr. Hart, in your position, if there's problems with the facilities, you know, like, for instance, somebody's not regularly getting phone service or a whole area is not regularly getting phone service, is that something that generally you become aware of?
If a whole area is not, I generally do at that point, yes.
Before August, September, and October of 2013, when this water mainline construction project began, were you aware of any overriding problems with the facilities and service provided in the Ross area?
No.
That's all the questions I have.
Right. Mr. Lindbergh, do you have further questions?
A couple questions. has RTC contacted Northern Excavating about the payments, you know, and any invoices?
Every month we send an invoice.
But have they called or sent a letter?
We send an invoice every month.
And there's been no other communication other than just the invoices?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. On Exhibit 14 and 15, it shows, you know, the yellow lines and the blue lines where the cables are. Are those in the exact location where the, as they're marked? Or is that just a general proximity of their routes?
On 14 and 15, I believe these are a general proximity because we overlaid. This is a Google map
right.
That was overlaid.
Could they be 10 feet away or 2 feet away or 20 feet away, but just shows the proximity?
From this map? I suppose it's possible they could be 10 feet away on this map.
And that one invoice for the bore, you mentioned it's been invoiced out, but the bore has not been done.
That's correct.
And it's been well over a year and a half, basically, since it was fixed after it was...
That is correct.
On the repair. I take it you're familiar with your, you know, operations on when you put in your fiber lines or copper lines, right? The general construction sequence?
I don't understand the question.
Do you know how it's installed? And do they have to meet certain practices for compaction? Or for and location-wise, of when they put these in, they follow the route as set by your engineer?
They would need to follow a route. I don't know on all the compaction rules and all that.
Are you familiar with waterline installation in, you know, in improved areas like a city street, whether it's in Minot or Williston or Ross, North Dakota, on what it takes to, when you put in a water main or a sewer main, what's involved with that?
I don't know all the details, but I do know that the city of Partial just had all their sewer replaced throughout the community, and we had no problems with the contractor that did that work.
Are you familiar with backfill procedures on this type of construction, whether it's water or sewer?
I don't know the specifics of backfilling, though.
How about compaction standards that goes with backfill operations on meeting certain compaction densities and how that affects the installation of
I do not know the compaction standards.
When RTC has their lines installed, whether they're 2 feet deep or 3 feet or 4 feet deep, how are those backfilled? Are they just the trench just pushed in and just backfilled that way?
I don't know.
Are tampers used to compact the trench?
I don't know the answer to that.
Are you familiar with water and sewer construction and how backfilling operations go on that?
No.
Were you on site at all in Ross for any cable cuts or line locates or anything?
No.
That's all I got.
Right. Thank you very much. Ms. Jeffco-Sackle?
We don't have any questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Kalk?
No, ma'am.
No, I'm good.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes, I do. Thank you. I'm looking at exhibit number 14. The red circle there for right at the intersection of Central Avenue and 2nd Street West, I see one circle that seems to be for cases 878 and 880. Are they in the exact same place and a week apart, or what should I read into that?
878 is a four fiber drop that was cut 815. And 880 is the 144 fiber. And I believe that my guess is, and Cassie can maybe answer this better than me, but there must be a vault there. And it could have happened on either side of the vault. You can have a 144 coming into the vault on one side and a four fiber or whatever coming out on the other.
But they did happen 6 days apart. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then on exhibit 15... most of these circles on either Exhibit 14 or Exhibit 15 are kind of about the same size, except for that one for case number 882 that covers the whole block. Can you explain why that is so much larger of an area marked off?
I believe when the map was produced, we knew it happened, not the exact spot, but within that city block is where that happened. Most of them happened at an intersection. That one happened within the city block. And Cassie could probably tell you more definitively within that circle where the cut was.
Is it possible between 882 and 883 because the circles overlap? And if I... made my chart right based off of Exhibit 9, they happened the same day that was the same accident, or not accident or violation or however, whatever the term is.
My understanding was there was two different cuts.
But they could be in the same place on the same day, according to this.
882 and 883 did happen on the same day, but I do not believe they were in the same location. And again, Cassie can testify to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong?
Nothing further.
Mr. Lindbergh, anything further?
No, not at this time.
Ms. Chico-Sackle?
No, thank you.
Commissioners? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Hart. You may step down. At this point, does anyone wish to take a break? Should we proceed to our next?
Maybe 5 minutes.
All right. Let's take a short break then. And 5 minutes as suggested by the chairman.